and welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Giselle Donnelly, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm joined by my colleagues,
Julia Zsozsa with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington Universities.
And Dalibor Rohach, also with AEI.
Today, we're very pleased to be joined by Phillips O'Brien, a historian who is in residence at the University of St. Andrews, but more importantly, for our purposes, is one of the most astute observers of the Ukraine war. To recap, Phil's prescience on the war would take the entire program. He's also the co-host of a great podcast on the war, so I will put links to Phil's podcast and his Substack in the show notes so you can follow them if you're listening to our podcast. Our podcast is dedicated to the issues arising along what we call the Eastern Front, which is a line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider subscribing, rating, reviewing us. And you can get this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or all other podcast services. Phil, I'm sorry for the rocky start, but it's really a great opportunity to welcome you back to the program. There's a lot to catch up on. In particular, you remain resolutely optimistic and remarkably on point in your analysis of the war. I'd like to begin by quoting from your most recent weekend publication, and I want to talk about the Ukrainian deep strike operations. But I'd like to begin with your analysis of the reticence of the Biden administration to allow the Ukrainians to strike targets inside Russia. So this won't be too painful, but it's, I thought, a very on-point quote. The United States has been so powerful for so long that it has forgotten what it means to fight an existential war. It has certainly forgotten how to win one. The strategy the Biden administration is now imposing on Ukraine has both aided its war efforts and hobbled it at the same time. By controlling what Ukraine can attack and what and can't attack with American weapons, the U.S. has made it much longer and more destructive war than it had to be. I think that's an accurate criticism, but it's a harsh criticism. And now in Washington, there is at last conversation about loosening the reins on the Ukrainian targeting system. Please give us your thoughts about why that's important, what the art of the possible is, and what Ukraine is already doing on its own to try to carry the war home to Russia.
Well, I mean, by the way, optimist is an interesting word. I've been very sort of down on the Biden administration and down on U.S. policy for a while. I mean, I believe Ukraine can win the war. So in that sense, maybe I'm an optimist, but Ukraine has to be aided the right way and it has to be allowed to fight the war the right way. So I'm certainly not an optimist in the way many things have happened. I don't believe this Russian army can't be defeated. It actually looks to me an imperfect military force that can be defeated. But that doesn't mean it will be defeated if, you know, Ukraine is cut out by the U.S. as it was in early 2024. So my optimism, you might say, is tempered optimism. In many ways, I've been really surprised by the poor level of American policy as exemplified by this issue of keeping Ukraine from attacking military targets in Russia. Now, why it's come to the fore now is because of the Kharkiv offensive. That before that, actually, the Russians had been launching their ground attacks from occupied Ukraine against Ukrainian forces. So their artillery was in occupied Ukraine. Most of the infrastructure for doing the attacks was in occupied Ukraine. However, in the case of Kharkiv, they launched the attack from Russia itself. And enormous asymmetric advantages were shown by that. The Russians could fire their artillery pieces and the Ukrainians couldn't fire back using American systems. So Russian forces could basically get to the border, to their launch places, in very good shape because they weren't going to be interdicted by American fire. So the reason it's become an issue now, I mean, the policy was always, I think, wrong, but it's become an issue now because the Russians used it to enormous advantage for their Kharkiv offensive. They were able to prepare it and launch it with the kind of openness and safety which no other attack has occurred. So that's, I think, why the issue has become so hot now, and that's why the eye of Sauron has turned on to the Biden administration and this policy. Now, it is, by the way, by nature, a flawed policy. It's flawed in two ways, because you are basically saying to one side in the war, you can't attack things, but the other side can attack you anyway it wants. And fundamentally, Ukraine's fighting for its existence. It needs to have the ability to do what Russia can do to it. Otherwise, you are actually saying to the smaller side, you have to fight under these huge restrictions. And Ukraine is, by the way, the Ukrainians are trying their best to fight against these. And I think we can talk about that later. So it's unjust, and it's militarily insensible to do this. The second thing, it's based on this failed escalation paradigm, which the administration has held to constantly, time and time again, and always shown to be wrong. I mean, from the very beginning, they can't get Abrams main battle tanks. They can't get Attackums. They can't get F-16s. They can't make attacks into Crimea. All of these restrictions that the administration has put on the Ukrainians in the use of American weapons, or either not giving them to them or making them wait as an attack in Crimea, based on the assumption that if you gave the Ukrainians this ability or capability, this would lead to escalation with Russia. None of that has ever happened. And yet they continue going back to this failed mindset of don't do this, don't do this, it will lead to escalation. I think basically a lot of IR theory has problems. And we're trying to fight a war based on IR theory, which just shelling doesn't work, okay? We just have to admit realism, shelling, a lot of that has deeply problematic stuff. But they still go back to it. That's where they go. On the other hand, we go through this dance every time. And we're near the, I think, three quarters of the way through the dance. And the first is the Biden administration, under no circumstances will we allow attacks into Russia. And then what happens is, well, the Europeans start going, maybe they should allow it. And then the Ukrainians start putting public pressure on it. And eventually the Biden administration gets dragged kicking and screaming into doing something it doesn't want to do. I think the fact that France and Germany both came out and in their own way said, yes, we favor these attacks, particularly the Germans, who are usually going along with the Americans.
Yes, seeing the Germans drag the United States into things is kind of looking through the wrong end of...
Isn't it a first? Yeah, it's a big deal anyway.
No, I agree. I'm babbling on. But I do think this is now starting to work itself out. But as always, it's far too late. This should have happened months ago.
Before we leave the escalation topic, I wonder how you would analyze the Ukrainian strike on the ballistic missile warning radar the other day. That would seem to really put the pin in the pillow of Putin's nuclear threats, which have been kind of the reason for caution in the West. So you wonder whether this is a matter of faith or whether there's now a counterfactual that will, sort of finally push the Biden administration over the finish line, if I can mix a trillion metaphors.
Well, those attacks were fascinating and deliberate. And I think they fit a number of Ukrainian goals, one of which is to put pressure on the administration. Now, one of the goals is that Ukraine can show to the Russians they can now attack the targets of the utmost strategic importance anywhere in Russia. By the way, that's different than being able to quickly home in on an artillery piece that is moving around on the Kharkiv front. So we have to talk about the difference in the policies. These are fixed radars, so they can't go anywhere. And the Ukrainians, they're big. They look like apartment buildings. So that the Ukrainians are able to get them. One, it puts pressure on Russia that the Ukrainians have been trying to do to spread out their anti-air defenses across Russia. The Russians have basically almost been leaving a lot of the domestic sites uncovered to send everything to the Ukraine war and its attempt by Ukraine to make them defend things. The second thing is this is a message to Washington. Now, by the way, this is my guess. From talking with Ukrainians, they don't tell me all their secrets. But it's saying to Washington, your escalation ideology is just wrong. We can attack the radars to protect Russia from strategic strike, and they won't do anything. They can't do anything. And I think that's partly a way to say to the Biden administration, on the one hand, your policy's wrong, but secondly, if you're going to restrain us in terms of what we can attack, we're going to attack other things that we can. So it's also, I think, a message to the Biden administration going, you don't let us attack the artillery, we'll attack other things that you don't like because you're not helping us in the way you like. I do know there is a growing exasperation with U.S. policy in Ukraine. I mean, they really, the last 5 months hit them very hard. They never thought they would be cut off in the way that they were cut off with no notice, and that they would be left hanging and have their soldiers die in high numbers and forced to fight with no ammunition. You know, they really believed Biden when he went to Kyiv and said, "We are with you as long as it takes." Unfortunately for them, they believed that.
So before we move into bigger strategic things, I want to follow up on the striking Russian territory and the ranges, because that's a bit of a discussion. And I think it's important for us and for our audience to sort of lay it down and try to understand on my end as well. So just to state the obvious, the reason why the issue of the United States not permitting or not recommending, as they said, to Ukraine to use Western provided weapons to strike Russian territory is that Kharkiv is very close to the border. It's like 20 miles to the border. So basically, Americans are saying if you were using a sling to hit over the territory, it shouldn't be an American sling, right? And then what I've also seen, beyond the pressure that comes from the NATO Secretary General, increasingly, like you said, Germany and France, here on the Hill, including from the Republican side, from all sides possible, I've seen a bit of a nuance. And I'm afraid of what would happen if this would be the policy that the Biden administration adopts. And then the question will be to you to lay out a bit to us what these ranges mean. So Victoria Nuland came out a few days ago. She's out of the administration now to say maybe we should consider giving Ukraine a bit of a range, like starting with an incremental smaller range. And then if nothing happens and World War III doesn't happen, then we can continue increasing the range around Kharkiv. Now, from what I understand from the Ukrainians, the situation is as follows. Kharkiv risks becoming in range for artillery. And so that would mean that the United States could say to Ukraine, you can hit within the range to sort of create an area denial within that range and prevent artillery from bombing down the city, which would be roughly 30 kilometers, about 18, 20 miles, right, from the border. However, the big contingent of troops that the Russians are accumulating for a potential attack is about 100 kilometers or 60 miles from the border around Kursk, if I'm not mistaken. And so it seems to me that there's a possibility that the Russians are taking that into account and that the Americans might be saying in the next few days to the Ukrainians, okay, you must be able to defend your city, but only within artillery range, not within further range, what we call or you called rear. So could you explain in better terms or more comprehensive terms what that would mean for the Ukrainian capacity to defend the city?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost certainly probably the way this will first happen in stages. And the immediate thing is, the Russians have crossed the border at Kharkiv, but they still haven't taken the small town of Vovshansk and whatever. But they can fire artillery supporting their forces attacking Vovshansk from well within Russia, within 20 miles of the border. And before that, before up to now, the Ukrainians couldn't use their American artillery systems to take those Russian artillery systems out. So they couldn't use those because that was forbidden by the US. So the minimum change will be to give the Ukrainians the ability to attack military targets attacking them from within Russia. I mean, that would be the absolute change. It would be very different from attacking troop concentrations 100 miles back. That, I think, the Biden administration will take some time to adjust to. But I think that is the first step. The first step is actually, if you're being fired at by something in Russia, you have the ability to fire back at it. Now, in odd ways, the Biden administration has okayed it with Patriots firing at aircraft because the Ukrainians have done that. So the Ukrainians have basically sniped Russian aircraft by pushing the Patriots very close to the border a few times and catching Russian aircraft flying over Russia. But maybe in their own weird mind, that's a defensive thing. They also have these sort of notion of defensive and offensive warfare. But I think what they haven't yet is done the minimum in the ground war, which is to attack the artillery. That is probably first. But again, as you point out, Russia still has the huge symmetric advantage of being able to organize its offensive without any hindrance, you know, not that far from the border. And that provides enormous strategic advantage because they can build up this force and threaten to move it anywhere. They can move it to Sumy. They can move it into Belarus. So the Ukrainians have to actually be responding to the fact that there is a force they can't attack, but they can attack it relatively soon by moving around. But I think that kind of ability will probably be kept for a while to attack 100 miles, which they could with ATACMS. They could actually devastate this troop buildup.
And that's a real Russian vulnerability. It's taking one of the Russians' real weaknesses and protecting them.
Yep. I mean, I'm not hopeful about that right away, put it that way.
So there is this question of ranges and restrictions we placed on the weapon systems we provided to the Ukrainians. But if you were to sort of step back and assume for a moment you were a benevolent dictator and you were just given the supplemental bill to spend as you please, what weapon systems would you prioritize that the current administration is not prioritizing? What is sort of missing in the sort of current approach, as far as we can tell, that would really make a difference to the Ukrainians?
What would I give, which they would never give? First, I'd give a lot of JASMs, which are the U.S. cruise missile, which the U.S. has tons of these things sitting in stocks, which they're never going to use, with as many ATACMS as you can manage to allow Ukraine to run an actual large-ranged campaign. Because right now, they have a few hundred Storm Shadows and Scalps, really tiny numbers of these things, and they're flying Cessnas packed with bombs, really primitive, crude, long-range UAVs to do their range campaign. It's having effect. I mean, we can see it's having effect in the sort of Black Sea Fleet and places like that. But I would give them a full range capability. So I would give them JASMs, which they don't have, which the U.S. has in large numbers and doesn't need. That's a cruise missile. And I'd give them far more of the ATACMS than they do have, and ATACMS of, you know, all different types of warheads, and give them the ability to do that, which would also put pressure on the Germans to give Taurus. And then all of a sudden, you have real momentum to allow Ukraine to degrade. By the way, what's going to happen for the next 8 months is pretty clear. Ukraine's going to defend. The last few months are really hard on them, and they suffered a great deal with very little ammunition. They're not going to do anything. They're not capable of taking any offensive action at this point. And they, I think, do understand that. So what you need to do is start collapsing the Russians from behind. You need to provide the Ukrainians partly what they will get from the U.S., which is weapons to hold the line. The Biden administration will send them weapons to hold the line, and they'll do well on that. But then they need to give them the ability to start collapsing the Russians from behind to prepare for 2025.
Talk to me about what you believe about the Ukrainian targeting process. As you say, they have relatively few assets. You know, the history of strategic strike campaigns is checkered, to put it mildly.
Well, I don't think it's as checkered as people say.
Okay, well, yes. Well, so I'm asking the air power expert to rack and stack what the art of the possible is for the Ukrainians.
With what they have now, it's only pretty minimal. Because what they have now is pretty basic systems that are not terribly precise and not in enough numbers to run a major campaign. I mean, to run a major strategic campaign against Russia, you would need lots and lots of weapons. They could come back. Because again, taking out a target is really hard. So the Ukrainians can actually attack a Russian oil refinery and hit it, but in a few weeks it'll be repaired. So you need the ability to come back and come back regularly and attack targets. The Ukrainians obviously do have some kind of strategic strike targeting system. Who's doing it is an interesting question. Is it the Air Force? Is it military intelligence? Is it special forces? Is it the new unmanned service? There could be a lot of different competitors bureaucratically as to who's making this decision. But we have seen a number of strategic strike options. Most recently were the radars. But before that, there was a considered campaign against oil refineries, which had some strategic effect, but again, it's simply not of the mass you need to keep it going. So I think that's what they're learning. What people do learn at war is it's much harder to destroy a target than you think.
I want to also ask you about GPS, with the risk that we're going into spatial warfare, but it does become increasingly relevant to the war. Was it a few days ago this weekend that I saw on the front page of the Washington Post an article about that? So basically, I think, in my understanding, the story is is that increasingly, no matter how high-tech the weapons are that we're giving Ukraine, particularly thinking about HIMARS, but essentially all the stuff is guided by GPS. And what the Russians are doing, they started in the Baltic Sea, which affects civilian air traffic as well. Now we're seeing it increasingly in the Black Sea and, of course, across Ukraine. They're jamming the GPS and they're using for their own weapons a different kind of system. So tell us a little bit about how much that is affecting Ukraine in the battle itself, but also what kind of implications this has for Western weapons and Western warfare.
Well, I mean, both sides now are engaged in this intense electronic warfare fight. So both Russia and Ukraine are putting massive amounts into trying to defang range systems coming at them by breaking the GPS connection and whatever. For some reason, it works on some systems, but it hasn't worked that well for the Russians on others. Like, it actually hasn't worked on ATACMS. As far as we can tell, they've not intercepted or blocked a single ATACMS. I've not seen evidence of that. It also has only worked a little bit on Storm Shadows and Scalps. I think there's been a few interceptions that might have occurred. It does tend to work a lot on UAVs, which are simpler device and huge numbers of these UAVs. It also worked on the smaller American glide bombs very well. The people had a lot of hope when the people are saying, oh, they don't need ATACMS, they're about to get these glide bombs. But actually, the Russians did a very good job of intercepting the glide bombs. So it's a question of maybe the way the GPS, you know, the hardened protection among the guidance system and how easy it is to interfere with. But so far, they haven't been able to stop a lot of the really advanced U.S. systems. I don't think they'd be able to stop the JASMs at this point. Right? That's one of the reasons I like the JASMs, is I think that they would be very difficult for the Russians to intercept. But the point you bring up is true. Both sides are having this huge struggle over electronic warfare. And if one side could, one, learn to suppress the others, that would be an enormous advantage. If you could start suppressing the other sides of electronic warfare, then you can attack almost anything you want. On the other hand, if you develop an electronic warfare that could really shut down a whole area and not allow it to be attacked, that would be an enormous benefit for it. So we sort of have this cat and mouse game that's going on.
There's also an asymmetry in the employment of these things. I mean, the Russians have been able to use glide bombs against cities, which are, the need for precision is much, much less.
Yeah, I mean, the Russians, they send these things and just blow up whole blocks because they don't care what they hit or they don't hit, and therefore they don't need to be guided as well. Yeah, I mean, the glide bombs have been a real asset to Russia in the last few months simply because they've been pounding away and they don't need to be too accurate. And the Ukrainians are having trouble intercepting them.
So I wonder if we might just widen the aperture a little bit. Obviously, there are two items that have been in the news lately that I think are worth reflecting on. The first one is the upcoming NATO summit and the extent to which the administration seems to just seize the opportunity to celebrate the 75th anniversary without really offering a sort of clear strategic path forward for Ukraine or for Eastern European security at large. The second one are these noises coming out of Russia about Putin being supposedly interested in negotiations. I think we all sort of share the sense that, you know, any peace agreement has to be sustainable, and that means Russia has to give up on its maximalist war objectives, and there is no sense that is actually happening. But what is it, that's sort of this postmodern sort of question, like, you know, how do you feel about the upcoming NATO? So, like, you know, how can we try to help sort of change the conversation to something more constructive than...
What would make for a truly successful summit?
There you go. Thanks, Giselle.
Well, it won't happen. The thing that would happen would be a roadmap for Ukrainian membership to NATO. Clear roadmap when and the steps that need to go. This, the Biden administration and the Germans don't seem to be willing to give. I mean, actually, God, this is one of the things they're terrified of NATO, Ukraine, making Ukraine a promise about entry into NATO that has any concreteness beyond nice words. I actually think the summit will be a bit of a fiasco because of this. That, you know, yes, there'll be celebration, woohoo, we're all in NATO, but NATO's not under attack. What you will actually accentuate is the real difference between European states, particularly the frontline Eastern Front states, and the U.S. They want Ukraine into NATO. I don't think there's any state, well, Hungary, because they're a bit barking mad right now, but most of the states in Central and Eastern Europe want Ukraine in NATO, because they believe it's a key part of their own security going forward. And they know if Ukraine's not in NATO, it will be a constant area of instability. The Biden administration at this point does not want to go down that path, or does not want to concretely go down that path. They had that horrible NATO summit last summer, which was one of the worst controlled summits I've seen. And I can't believe this one will be any better in the results that it has. They don't want to do anything that will perhaps lead to a collapse of the Putin regime. They sort of want this regime to stay because they view it as a stable Russian regime. And therefore, they don't want to give Ukraine the kinds of thing like NATO membership, which they might see as destabilizing Russia so much. So I don't have a lot of hope for it, for anything concrete. And I am worried about these splits between the US and Europe that are growing every day.
Okay, enough international politics. Let's get back to Ukraine. The other topic I particularly wanted to get your take on, Phil, was that of Ukrainian manpower and conscription and so forth. Much controversy about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ukrainians have not done that well. I mean, Ukrainians are terrified about their own demographics. And when you go to Kyiv, what's interesting is you will see a lot of young men from 18 to 30 on the streets. Why? I mean, they're not in uniform all over the place. The Ukrainian army is basically a lot of older guys now. And they haven't had general conscription. They have just now started a process of enrolling everyone for conscription. But they didn't seem to want to do that because they have been trying to protect their younger population for demographic reasons. They also said for industrial purposes, you know, to help the domestic economy, they didn't want to do it. But ultimately, they are fighting for national existence. And I think they put that off, and they've put it off too long, that they have to rise their population.
There's been a lot of Western commentary on this, but I'm not up to speed on how Ukrainians themselves talk about this.
They have said that they are worried about their demographic future because they already were in significant demographic problems before February 2022. Many of the young men left the country quite soon. If more go and more get killed, then they end up with a deficit of young men in their 20s. And they also did say about that. And there's also, by the way, Zelensky's a domestic politician. Supposedly he doesn't like to do things that are unpopular.
So this is the question I ask every Ukrainian I meet. And the answers obviously revolve around what Phil just said. There's also the sense that throughout this war, we've kept the private economy going, right? Like the sort of, we haven't really switched to a sort of wartime economy. We haven't nationalized things. Banks are stable and you just need people working in those places. And we already took a massive hit in the first year of the war in terms of economic growth, infrastructure is being destroyed. So we can't afford to just like send men through the meat grinder. And I think it's being reinforced by the sense that, I mean, the West is not helping enough. Like, you know, like, are we going to send men, like, if we don't have weapons for them and enough ammunition? Like, what's the point? Like, it's a very different kind of country than Russia, which has, you know, no compunction about, you know, sending thousands to die.
I mean, say the U.S. had cut off aid permanently. You say no new congressional aid was approved. That was it. No NATO membership is on the cards. There would be an element in Ukraine that would accept a frozen conflict, I would think. At that point, because, as you say, they don't want to get their population slaughtered if they're not going to get help from the West to fight. If they're not going to get into NATO, then they would do something to keep the country going, even if that meant a short-term freeze on the line. That I think that would be something they would have had to consider if the U.S. had continued to cut it off. But yet they are worried. This is something that they don't want to have their country dead. They don't want to emerge victorious with no people. They're worried about the diaspora that's already left. How many millions have left since 2022?
6 million almost.
They want to be able to entice them back.
I also feel much like Dalibor that I need to say something here, and that is also on the individual level. If I were this year a Ukrainian young man that is still in Ukraine and is supposed to be conscripted, I would be very reluctant, to say the least, because I don't know what I'm fighting for. Last year and the year before, I knew what I'm fighting for, and I would think that I have enough support, but it's not. I think the NATO and EU membership are definitely a part of the motivation, and that's why the Ukrainians have been so insistent on a speedier and special process. And I cannot believe that the administration, even the people that I admire in the administration, are still saying, you know what, Ukraine is not ready. Do you want to have a Ukraine in NATO that is not ready? And I'm thinking, this is what you said about all Central and Eastern European countries. when the moment came. But last element here on the individual level, like we just said, if the West is not giving you the weapons to fight for and you don't know when, but almost certainly it will happen that the West under the Biden administration next year or under a Trump administration next year in a more polite form or in a more rude form is going to literally push them to the negotiation table in a position that is very precarious with a Russia that, by the way, doesn't want to negotiate and has no reason to do so, then why would you be risking your life for a front line that won't matter in 2 months from now? And I think this is something, that's why I felt the need to say something. This is something that I've seen a lot of superficial commentary from Western politicians, including here in Washington, D.C., that are saying, oh, now is the time for Ukraine to mobilize. But there is zero thought behind the human and social implications of this beyond the economics. So, yeah.
It would have been very difficult to convince a Ukrainian to sign up 3 months ago when the U.S. had cut the aid. And then you're saying, oh, yeah, sign up for an army with no artillery. Yeah, that's not necessarily a great argument. I mean, it does seem to be that, by the way, recruiting has picked up since the U.S. aid has been approved and it's gone better. In terms of motivation, it's fascinating. By the way, if you have conscription, by nature, they're not motivated. Conscription always comes into a war, usually comes into war much sooner than people think, that you end up, you know, having a rush to the colors in the first few months. But then by the first year, people start going, and you have to bring in conscription. So that's not unusual. What's unusual is how long Ukraine has waited in an existential war to do it. But you're right, you have to give them a purpose. On the one hand, they do have a purpose, and that is they will be wiped out by the Russians. They know that this is an existential war, and that in by itself is a motivation. And I think they can say, regardless of what happens, at least we can preserve most of Ukraine. You know, Russians still only have occupied, 18-19% of Ukraine. Most of Ukraine is still free. And the Russians, who have been on the offensive for 7 months now, how much of it have they taken? I mean, in this last period, it's probably been less than 1%.
Who could have named those villages 8 months ago?
Yes. So soldiers, you'd have to motivate them to say, look, we need to basically bloody the Russians for a year or two to get the best peace deal possible. That might be stuff to motivate, but it's a great question, the motivation.
Phil, we'll let you go here in a second, but I would like to wind up sort of in a spot where you and I first met, and that is the Western and particularly the American view of Russia, which was sort of inaccurate, to put it mildly, to begin with, but doesn't seem to have shown any signs of correction that I can really notice. Go ahead.
The Americans simply have a more benign view of Russia than Europeans, particularly Central and Eastern Europeans. I mean, you know, the discussion in Washington is if Russia is a slightly odd rogue state, you know, not really bad, you know, just a little off. Or in many ways, a normal state just trying to be powerful. You know, part of the U.S. dialogue actually sort of says Russia is simply doing what a realist vision of a state, maximizing its power in an unstable international world. So there's an attempt to look at Russia from that point of view. And of course, what we always have to remember is Russia's not an existential threat to the U.S. I mean, it can't conquer Ukraine. It's not a threat to the U.S. military. So the U.S. could just go home and Russia would be no threat to it now whatsoever in, you know, immediate terms. But for Europe, it's a profoundly different discussion. I mean, that's one thing. As an American who lives in Europe, it's fascinating to see the two. So you go to Helsinki, and they're not really worried about, you know, Russian collapse. Or you go to Poland. They're not like, oh, what a terrible thing it would be if Putin fall. You know, this is just not the way they think. And the way they react to it. So the Washington view is on the one set by Russianists. You know, the project that I've been working on, if you look at the analytical community, they were all Russianists. You know, none of them were Ukrainian specialists or anything else. They were Russianists, and they were the ones who were talking about the Russian military. And they're still there. What's fascinating is the same voices who got everything wrong on what Russia was are still there saying many of the same thing. So the dominance of the Russianists, I think, has been fascinating in an unhelpful way, particularly in the U.S.
Phillips O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us. I wish we could have you on as a sort of a monthly basis.
You would have been very depressed in February and March.
Well, we were very depressed in February and March, so we would have at least been able to share our misery, which, you know, misery loves company. So thanks for joining us. Let me say also thank you on behalf of my colleagues, Yulia Zhozha and Dalibor Rohach. Thank you to the audience for listening. If you enjoyed enjoyed this podcast. We've got lots more content on our AEI.org website. As I remembered to say at the beginning, you can get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and a whole bunch of other streaming services as well. We also publish a monthly newsletter that will keep you informed about the work that we do outside the podcast, our writings and rambling. So for the Eastern Front crew, for Phillips O'Brien, thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you on future Eastern Front podcasts. Until then, bye.